This is Audible.
Avalon Tower, part of the Fae Spy Academy series. Written by Cian Crawford and Alex Rivers. Narrated by Amanda Lee Cobb, a member of SAG-AFTRA.
Prologue.
Alex glances at the top floor of an apartment building, staring at the couple shagging against the window. Even from here, she can see the pleasure on the man's face, his breath misting the glass. That would be an infinitely better way to spend the day than the mission she has planned. She can imagine Agent Rain holding her like that, gripping her as he kisses her throat. But it will never happen. Love is strictly forbidden for the spies of Avalon Tower. The problem is, banning desire doesn't douse the heat. If anything, it fuels it. Sometimes Alex thinks all the Avalon spies are unsatisfied. Obsessed, lost in fantasies. Today, especially, her head isn't in the game, even though Fae soldiers probably lurk all around this place, waiting to run their swords through agents like her. Distraction is death, she reminds herself. She turns away, scanning the street for signs of her Fae enemies. She doesn't see anything amiss. In fact, it all looks perfectly calm, picturesque and quaint. Wrought iron balconies overhang the cobbled alley. Here, in the south of France, the scent of lavender mingles with the brine of the sea. The streets of this coastal town are ancient, stony, labyrinthine. At the bottom of the sloping road, wisps of fog curl over the Mediterranean. A café overlooks the sea. Café de la Forêt Enchantée. The meeting point is by the back door. She peers out across the outdoor tables, where a pretty woman with raven hair is eating cake and flirting with a waiter. Alex feels a pang of jealousy. For normal women, those who aren't spies trying to save the world, love is always a possibility. Focus, Alex. Still, a picture of serenity around her. No sign of the Fae soldiers, but no sign of Rain either. A church bell tolls, making her heart skip a beat. Rain should be here. He's usually early. She takes a slow, calming breath. She's always thinking of him, which is exactly why love is forbidden in the first place. It takes your mind off the mission and leads to stupid decisions. She's never told him how she feels, how she seems to always be looking for him. Every time she sees a reflection, she checks the glass to see if he's behind her, hoping to see his boyish smile instead of looking out for the enemy. Whenever she walks into the dining hall at Avalon Tower, she scans the room for his slender form. She's always coming up with excuses to get close to him, but she can never quite tell if he feels the same about her. The clouds slide over the sun and she feels a chill. She should stay at the beach, alert for any sign of the Fae, those terrifying soldiers in royal blue. But she's not going to leave here without Rain. He's late for the rendezvous, and her mind spins in a million horrible directions. Pulse racing, she climbs back up the hill. Her skin tingles with the hum of the veil emanating from the streets nearby, the misty barrier that separates this world from that of the Fae. In theory, it's a boundary that keeps them on one side and humans on the other, but it's not that simple. For one thing, you can never be sure exactly where the veil is. Sure, the Fae control it, but sometimes it seems to have a mind of its own. The magical boundary roams a bit, shifting its location ever so slightly. It's a hungry thing, and if it consumes you, you die. Every few weeks it leaves a curious tourist dead on the winding streets of southern France. Alex is one of the few people alive who can actually control it, who can stop it from killing those passing through. Casually she checks her watch, and dread skitters up her spine. Rain was supposed to be here 6 minutes ago. He's never late, especially not for an exfiltration operation. The fugitives should be just beyond the veil by now. She feels like she can hardly breathe. Spies are taught to suppress emotion, to maintain complete control of themselves, even when danger lurks in the shadows of every alley. But now, Alex feels her training fail as the terrifying possibilities race through her mind. What if he was slaughtered already? What if the veil shifted location and killed him? She'd lose her mind if anything happened to Rain, if she never got to see his brown eyes again, or had the chance to wrap her arms around him. She grits her teeth so hard that she nearly bites her tongue. Get it together. She masks her feelings with a wistful smile as she crosses the road to the gold and salmon-coloured shops on the opposite side. She pretends to look in the windows at the madeleines and croissants, the slices of cake. Anyone watching her would think she's just a hungry tourist on vacation, a cute blonde in a sundress.
Fog drifts across the street.
11 minutes late now. Alex's blood roars. Something is definitely wrong. She starts to march back to Café de la Forêt Enchantée. At last, she hears the whistle that is their signal, and she heaves a sigh of relief. It's coming from behind her. Did she miss him somehow? The signal is coming from a narrow lane, and Alex hurries over to it. She turns the corner, and the world tilts beneath her feet. Now she's face to face with a towering fae. Silver hair flows down his back, and he wears the dark blue velvet of a fae soldier. There's something about his eerie stillness, about the sharpness of his gaze, that sends fear ringing through Alex's bones. It's the metallic sheen in his green eyes that's so disorienting, otherworldly. His lip curls, exposing one of his sharpened canines. Alex reads nothing in his eyes except loathing. We've been compromised. Alex's heart slams and she turns to run, but her path is blocked by a second fae soldier and Alex is caught between them. She reaches for her dagger, but it's too late. A blade plunges into Alex's stomach and pain rushes through her. Her training takes over and she tries to pull her dagger, to dodge, to parry, to run, but her limbs don't obey her for some reason. She falls to her knees. Strange. Her wound doesn't hurt that much. She hardly feels it at all. Thoughts of rain flicker through her mind as she bleeds onto the stones. Chapter 1. 7 minutes earlier. I breathe in the scent of the ocean, a fragrance tinged with cypress, and sip my coffee. It's hot for early spring, and it almost looks like steam is rising from the sea. From my spot at Café de la Forêt Enchantée, I see the cloud of shimmering mist shearing across the landscape. My vacation has been heaven so far. The breeze rushes off the water and leaves a faint taste of salt on my lips. This place is good for my asthma, I think. The atmosphere in the south of France feels different than California. Here, the light is soft, honeyed, not the glaring, overwhelming harshness of the LA sun. Nearby, the magical veil rises to the sky like a wall of fog. It's eerie and undeniably beautiful. It moves sometimes, but I'm at a safe distance here. Just beyond the tables of the outdoor cafe, waves crash over the white rocks. This might just be my favorite place in the world. I manifested this trip with positive thoughts and vision boards. Also, many hours of minimum wage labor and eating cereal for dinner instead of going out to bars. This 2-week vacation is my destiny. Sure, I feel a twinge of guilt at leaving Mom behind, but there's no way I could pay for us both. And it would be better to have my friend Layla with me, but she's scared of going anywhere near the Fae border. She thinks they might still leap out of the veil and murder you at any moment, even if the guidebooks from our bookshop and the U.S. State Department clearly say it's safe. I pick up a sprig of lavender from the vase on the table and inhale. I'm still enjoying the lovely scent when a dark-haired waiter slides a slice of a blackberry cake onto the lace tablecloth before me.
Bon appétit.
I definitely ordered the lavender cake, but cake is cake. Thank you. As I take a bite, the fruity flavor bursts on my tongue. This slice costs the equivalent of 3 hours of work at the bookshop, but I try not to think about it. 15 years ago, the war made prices soar, and they never went down again. Luxuries like cake are stupidly expensive. Vacation, I remind myself. Another bite. The sugary tart flavors coat my tongue. Mom would be horrified. So many carbs, darling. She lives on vodka and boiled eggs. The waiter watches me take a bite and smiles. With his bright blue eyes and square jaw, he reminds me of someone, but I can't quite put my finger on it.
"It's delicious, yes?"
he asks. He must have pegged me as a tourist because he's speaking in heavily accented English. I nod. "C'est délicieux." His shoulders relax as he shifts to French himself.
"I'm glad. Are you here on holiday?"
He wears a flat cap over wavy brown hair. I arrived a week ago, only 1 week left. My chest clenches at the realization that my trip is already half over. For 5 years, I've looked forward to this, but I can't spend the other half of my vacation mourning the end of it, can I? I wish I could stay. Sure, it's a teensy bit lonely having my birthday cake at a table for one, but it's probably better than what I'd be doing at home.
"Where are you from?"
he asks. "The U.S., West Coast.
L.A.
L.A.? As in Hollywood? Are you an actress? A model?
He lowers his eyelashes, then looks up again.
Your hair is very striking. So unusually dark.
Is he flirting with me? Thank you. No, I'm not an actress.
I glance at the veil again. I can't seem to keep my gaze off it. What's happening on the other side?
Have you seen any? I turn to him and whisper. Faye? He blanches. It's almost like saying the word out loud sends a ripple of terror across the cafe, and for a moment I regret it. I catch the brief tightening of the muscles around his mouth until he softens them into a smile. He shrugs.
Sometimes they patrol the border on our side, but most of the south of France remains independent. We're safe here, and there's nothing to worry about. King Oberon has no interest in claiming more of France than he already has.
That's what I told Layla. Except I'd sounded convincing. And when he says it, it sounds distinctly rehearsed. What is he not saying? What I do know is this. 15 years ago, the Fae invaded France. When it first happened, the world was stunned. Until that point, no one even knew they existed. And then, suddenly, they were marching through Paris, commanding the boulevards. Their dragons circled above the Eiffel Tower. The Fae were beautiful, otherworldly, seductive, lethally violent, and hell-bent on conquest. The French military fought back and managed to keep some of the South free and under human control. Unoccupied. It's supposed to be safe. But as the clouds slide over the sun, I feel the atmosphere suddenly grow tense around me. It's hard to put my finger on it, but there's something sharp and grim in the air now, replacing the soft ambiance. I glance at the waiter, who still lingers by my table. Maybe there is more danger here than the tourist boards are willing to admit. Maybe Layla had a point. The night before, as I ate bouillabaisse in a restaurant by the sea, I overheard a man arguing with his wife, telling her that an anti-Fae resistance was fighting King Oberon. A magical cold war that played out behind the scenes, one with spies and secret missions. He made it sound like these spies had legendary skills, that they could kill a Fae in 2 seconds flat with their bare hands. That a highly skilled elite force was our only hope if we wanted to stop the evil king from taking the rest of France. His wife called him an idiot and told him to stop talking. But there's a tension here that makes me want to know more. I flutter my eyelashes. Have you heard anything about the secret resistance? I whisper. The waiter smiles, a dimple in one cheek.
Oh, that.
His smile is patronizing, and he rolls his eyes theatrically.
Rumors only. How would they fight the Fae in their lands? You cannot cross the veil into the Fae realm. And even if you did, the Fae would spot you as a human instantly. And anyway, they have magic. We don't. I really doubt such a resistance exists.
I glance at the veil again. Misty shades of faint violet and green twist and spiral, plunging into the ocean and rising up to dissipate in the clouds. If cell phones still worked, I'd be snapping photos like crazy. But electronics fizzled out with the arrival of the Fae. For whatever reason, Fae magic destroyed our most modern technology. The waiter sighs wistfully.
The veil is beautiful, isn't it? Is that what you came here to see?
Something about this waiter makes me uneasy, but I'm not sure what it is. He reminds me of someone I hate, but that's a completely irrational reason to dislike someone. I did want to see the veil, I admit. But also I used to come to France, years after the Fae invasion. Starting when I was 15, my mom would take me here. We stayed at a chateau in Bordeaux during the summers. He flashes me a smile.
I've been. Amazing vineyards, of course. Shame that we lost half of them to the occupation.
My stomach tightens as I remember those summer vacations. Our days were spent with my mom drinking all the wine in the vineyard. Then, when she was properly wasted, she'd urge me to flirt with rich French guys who could do a lot for me. I remember she was so loud and drunk one night. Oh, that's why he looks familiar. He resembles the dark-haired aristocratic demi-fae who broke my heart when I was a teenager. What a great example of a memory that should have stayed repressed. The waiter is nearly as handsome as that demi-fae, but not quite. Humans rarely have the shocking, heartbreaking beauty of the fae. I stare at him over the rim of my coffee cup. What's your name?
Jules.
He seems to think this is an invitation, and he pulls out the chair across from me. He stares at me dreamily across the table.
And yours?
Nia.
I'm finishing my shift soon.
This is clearly suggestive. But what does Jules have in mind exactly? Maybe he wants to whisk me off to a beautiful hidden bookstore full of rare volumes. Or maybe he wants a quick fumble in a hotel room, in which case the answer is no. I take another bite of the cake, tasting the confiture, and dab at my lips with the napkin. I still haven't satisfied my curiosity, so I lean forward and whisper, "What do you think it's like now? In the occupied regions? In Fey France?" His eyes dart furtively to the left, then the right. He leans forward on his elbows and quietly says,
"I try not to think about it. I hear things I wish I could forget."
He keeps his blue eyes locked on me, as if suggesting I should do the same. I wait for him to go on. When he doesn't, I ask, "What sort of things?"
"I see them coming through here sometimes," he says. "Fugitives."
I stare at him. This definitely wasn't in the tourist guidebooks. What fugitives?
"The Fey King, Oberon, hunts anyone who doesn't support him. He accuses scores of people of treason and slaughters them. I think he particularly hates the Demi-Fey. He suspects them of disloyalty and he demands complete fealty. The police here are supposed to report any Demi-Fey they see escaping. Otherwise, Oberon might invade the rest of France."
He straightens.
"I mean, he won't. He knows he can't win. Even if electronics don't work, we have guns and iron bullets, and we help to keep things under control. We protect what we have."
A shiver runs over my skin. "I see. And how do you do that?"
"We report any fugitives we see. No one is allowed to help them. It keeps the status quo intact."
He opens his hands and shrugs again.
"What can we do? We have to keep the peace. We can only enjoy life and keep things the way they are."
A tendril of guilt twines through me, and I try to push it away.
"Is there a special reason for your vacation?"
he asks. "It's my 26th birthday." He grins.
"Well, Nia, we must celebrate. Has it been a good birthday so far?"
Church bells toll, and the sound echoes across the stones and out to the sea. The air grows colder, grayer. Probably one of the best, definitely far from the worst. My worst birthday was when I was 15, back in L.A. Mom promised to throw a huge party. This was when we still lived in a house in Laurel Canyon with gorgeous views of the city, and it felt like my one chance to impress the rich girls from my school. But she started drinking champagne early and fell through a glass table while the DJ was playing an ABBA song. She kept laughing hysterically as she bled all over the hardwood floors. The girls from school never spoke to me again. Oh, good. Another memory that should have stayed under the surface. I muster a smile. Jules turns to look behind him, and I realize that a cold hush has fallen over the outdoor cafe. The sea no longer sparkles. It's churning under a gray sky. Then my gaze flits to a pair of fey marching over the white rocks. Actual, real-life, terrifying fey. The kind that slaughter people for being disloyal. Fear flutters through my chest. I've never seen full-blooded fey before. I find myself staring at their towering, godlike physiques. But it's the eerie, otherworldly way they walk that holds my attention. With every graceful movement they make, my mind screams that danger lurks between me and the roiling sea. A primal fear that dances up the nape of my neck and makes it hard to breathe. They look so out of place here. Warriors from another time, draped in dark cloaks that seem to suck up the light around them. Long hair flows down their backs, silver and black, and their bright eyes send alarm bells ringing through me. Not to mention the swords. My mind flicks back to the stories of what happened when they first invaded Breton. The burned homes, the corpses left in their wake. One of them glances at me, bright emerald eyes with a metallic sheen. He looks lethal. My stomach flips. I'm not even doing anything wrong. I'm a tourist, legally here on vacation. But I suddenly feel like I'm about to die. My pulse races as I look down at the cake again, trying to go unnoticed. I stare at it, gripping my fork. When I look up again, the two fey are gone, and I exhale slowly. Around me, the cafe conversation resumes. Jules turns back to me, frowning.
"It's unusual to see the Fey Patrol here. They must be looking for someone. A fugitive, perhaps. A demi-fey."
He narrows his eyes at me.
"The demi-fey are very beautiful, like you."
He stares at me, his eyes narrowing. His words linger in the air.
"And they don't always have pointed ears, you know. You said you are from America?"
I can feel his suspicion, and a shiver runs down my spine. Suddenly, I desperately want to get away from this guy. America, yes, I clear my throat. Do you have a phone here I can use? With a clenched jaw, Jules points inside.
It's by the back entrance.
I drop some money on the table and stand. Head down, I cross into the cafe. There's a back door, I think, in case I need to run out of here. Am I being paranoid that the waiter suspected me? Or was Layla right about coming here? I'm not sure which idea I dread more, the actual danger I could be in, or the gloating I told you so I'd get from her. I find the phone by a door that looks out onto a side street. Like most phones these days, it's a refurbished antique, the only kind that still works. It's beautiful, really, with a copper body and ivory handset. I pick it up and put it to my ear, blinking at the loud ringtone. I dial my mother's number, turning the old rotary dial, then wait as the line crackles. There is a metallic tang in the air that sets my teeth on edge. I close my eyes and inhale.
Hello?
My mom's voice sounds strange, distorted by wires and distance. Hi, Mom, it's me. I try to control my wavering voice.
Nia,
she says heavily. I'm glad you finally decided to call.
I called 3 days ago, I remind her brightly. It's been at least a week.
Okay, there's no point in arguing. How are you doing? I'm broke again, and my feet are aching. Soak them in a plastic tub of water, Mom. Just make sure to turn the water off before it overflows. I listen distractedly to her as I stare outside. Don't leave the water running unless you're there. She's overflowed the sink so many times.
Well, I can't remember everything when it's just me on my own.
Please try to eat well, I say. I left out tons of healthy groceries for you. Something catches my eye outside. There's an alleyway across from this cafe, and a bright crimson smear streaks across the ground. What is that? It's my birthday, I say, trying to focus. You were in labor for 10 hours, remember? It's her favorite thing to say on my birthday.
Today?
Nia, you keep getting older. She makes it sound like an accusation. Well, it's better than the alternative, right? I'm staring at that bright streak of red, but my view is blocked by a group of tourists who walk by, dressed in costumes like the Fae, sheer materials in rich colors, burgundy and chartreuse. One of them drops a bit of jewelry, a blue crystal pendant, but the woman doesn't seem to notice.
My little Nia all grown up, Mom is saying. You know, I was already doing modeling jobs when I was
14. You're still so pretty, Mom. I tap on the glass to try to get the woman's attention, but she doesn't seem to hear me. She keeps walking, and her beautiful blue jewel gleams on the sidewalk. A heavy sigh from Mom.
Well, I have crow's feet now.
No, you don't. You don't look a day over 19. Mom, I have to go. I'll call you soon.
You'd better, because you left me here all by my...
I hang up and push out the back door of the cafe. I pick up the jewel from the sidewalk and glance at it. It's beautiful, otherworldly, and it gleams in the sunlight.
Excusez-moi, I call out.
The woman turns around and I hurry closer to the group, smiling. You dropped this, I say in French. But as I look closer at them, my smile starts to fade. They're not wearing costumes, I realize. They are actual fae, and some of them have delicately pointed ears. Or more likely, they're demi-fae. Are they fugitives? Their gossamer clothes are ripped and dirty. My pulse races. The Fae soldiers aren't far from here. Did Jules say they'd be slaughtered on the spot? Or dragged back across the veil? They aren't wearing shoes, and the fear in their expressions is clear. It's the same look that Mom gets after too much coke. One of them even looks like her, with dark hair and gaunt cheeks. A blonde woman staggers next to her, hugging herself. Her eyes look haunted, too. If someone like Jules catches them, he'll send them straight to their deaths. One of them is just a bony little boy with haunted eyes and emaciated cheeks. Children need looking after. The thought screams in my mind. I glance back to that alleyway. With sickening clarity, I can now see that crimson smear of blood brushed over the stone, as if someone had dragged a dead body backward. My stomach turns. What's going on here? I quickly hand the jewel over to the woman. You dropped this. She grabs my arm.
Alex? Rain?
Her accent is one I don't recognize. I stare at her in confusion. No, that's not me. I'm sorry. I glance past her. A woman is leaning out of her doorway, glaring at us. She wears a pinched expression.
Who are you?
the woman barks in French. She's glaring directly at me. Now I'm under suspicion. Am I about to be turned in? Am I about to be a blood smear on the pavement? Fear drags its claws through my chest. Layla was right.
Chapter 2. We're just out of sight of the cafe's outdoor tables, and there's another lane off to the left. The angry woman is staring at us, waiting for an answer. I glance at the little boy again, who looks up at me with big brown eyes. I could turn and run, but two things stop me. One is purely selfish. I've already been seen with them, and Jules suspects me entirely on the basis that he thinks I'm too cute to be human. But the other reason is that I cannot stomach the thought of this little boy becoming another pool of blood. I smile and wave at the woman who's staring at us from the doorway. "Tour group," I yell in French. "Fae-themed. Pretty good costumes, right?" I give her a cheerful smile, then turn back to the group. "Bonjour à tout le monde," I call out to the haggard demi-fae, beckoning them toward the road that cuts off to the left. "Nous pouvons commencer la visite. Bienvenue à la vie frontière magique." I grin at them, and they all stare at me, fear etched on their faces. I just told them that we could start the tour and welcomed them to the magical border town. They don't seem to understand what I'm trying to do. "On the beach," I continue in French, "we will have a view of the incredible veil, the barrier to the Fae Kingdom. Until 15 years ago, most people didn't even know they existed. They lived in another dimension, one created by magic long ago. Proxelinde, Fae Realm. Oberon's own kingdom was withering, so they invaded our dimension, and he occupied France for more territory. Now the Fae have two regions, Proxelinde in the other dimension, and Fae France in our world. The French fought back valiantly, preserving some of the south." The stone road gives way to hot white sand. At least on the beach, all the bare feet will make sense. I give a speech that makes war sound dramatic and heroic. The truth is, of course, horrific, rife with senseless deaths and violence. But tour guides don't dwell on that. War tourism is supposed to be fun. I frantically gesture for them to follow me to the beach, over sand and short shrubs that smell like thyme. When they don't follow, I grab the blonde woman by the hand and pull her along. The others reluctantly shuffle after her. They all look so thin, so terrorized. What happened to them in the Fae Realm? And what will happen to me if someone decides I'm one of them? "After the peace talks," I go on, "King Oberon promised not to claim any more territory, and we have now established the status quo." Lowering my voice, I quickly ask, "Est-ce que qu'on parle français?" I switch to English. "Does anyone here speak English?" Blank stares. Maybe I should try the Fae language? "Stop trying to speak in Fae," one of the women whispers in English. Her eyes are strangely bright, an otherworldly violet. "I understand English. Your Fae pronunciation is painful." Ouch. I've been trying to learn from a book, but the pronunciation was never clear on the page. "Okay," I answer softly, beckoning them closer. "Listen, you all need to get off the streets. Now." "Why would you say that?" She flicks her hair behind her shoulder in what looks like an attempt at a casual gesture. "We're ordinary English citizens on holiday." Her Fae accent makes every word twirl beautifully, and she doesn't sound remotely English. "Sure," I say dryly. "Listen, anyone can see what you are." Someone in the group gasps, and the violet-eyed woman turns to run. I grab her by the arm. "No, don't run. It will only call attention to you." Her lower lip juts out. "Are you an agent?" "An agent? Are those the spies I heard the man talk about yesterday? The secret resistance? Sadly, I'm no hero." "No, I'm not an agent. My name is Nia. What's yours?" She hesitates for a few seconds, looking as if she regrets her earlier words. Finally, she sighs.
"Emeliana, we were supposed to meet a contact, but he never showed up. He had a secret way through the city to the docks. Disguises, counterfeit passports, weapons to protect ourselves. He has everything we need, but he's not here."
"I don't have those things."
"Can you protect us if we get attacked?" she asks desperately.
"If we were attacked, the only thing I could do would be to distract the attackers with a terrible Fae accent." No.
"Then you can't help us."
Her eyes mist with tears.
Up close, I see that there are flecks of gold in the violet of her pupils. Her fingers are delicate. Even with her ears covered by her black hair, these are telltale marks of a demi-fae.
I'll have to try to summon help.
She lifts the blue jewel. Summon? I glance at the crystal. It seems to pulse with an unearthly light. What does that do?
It's a magical cry for help, she says, her voice tight. Once I break it, it'll erupt with a very loud noise and bright light. It might summon the resistance here. It's a last resort.
She tugs at the pendant. No! I grab her fist before she can yank it off. The streets are patrolled by Fae soldiers today. You'll get us both in trouble. The Fae will be here in seconds if you use that. Listen, I have a better idea. She releases her crystal.
What?
People here are used to tourist groups, I say. The South Coast has lots of visitors who come from all over the world to see the Veil. Some of them dress like Fae. We'll pretend to be a tour group, and I'll be your guide, okay? That's what I was doing before, acting as if I were your tour guide. It'll explain why you're all grouped together and why you're dressed like this. She nods.
Okay.
Good, but you don't quite look right. I scan the group again. 12 of them. Some of them don't look Fae, but others are obviously so. I point to a man whose ears are more noticeably pointy. Put on that woman's hat. We need to hide those ears. And you, miss, hide that pendant. It's clearly Fae. Anyone with long hair, use it to cover your ears. I had to make them seem human. The group quickly follows my instructions. They seem reassured by my presence, which sends a pang of guilt twisting through my chest. They have no idea how badly I'm out of my depth. But I'm deep in this now, so I plaster on a smile and march forward. On the beach, tourists are sitting out with picnics and under umbrellas. The light radiates off the sea, and the marine wind toys with my sundress. The sand's heat warms my soles through my sandals. I settle into my role as a tour guide, projecting my voice and speaking in French. If you all follow me, ladies and gentlemen, down this way, back in the year of the invasion, a number of people fled the Fae realm. Luckily for us these days, there's peace between us and our Fae neighbors. The local police work in tandem with the Vale guards to maintain law and order, and to keep the status quo intact. We stand out on the beach and I lead them toward the town's streets where other tourist groups usually roam. The group follows me obediently across the sand. Some of them still look frightened, but others look curiously around them. Any idea of where you have to go at the docks? I ask Eliana in a low voice.
I think just northeast of here.
I swallow hard. That would be the dock directly next to the Vale. Okay. We'll have to go up that street, I think.
You think? You don't know?
I don't live here. I arrived this week. Eliana mutters an unfamiliar word in the Fae language. It doesn't sound very nice. Over here, ladies and gentlemen, I holler. I didn't realize how difficult it was to be a tour guide. Talking loudly while marching, constantly turning around to address the group. My asthma starting to act up. My breath coming in wheezes. That statue over there commemorates the French peace treaty with the Fae. Over 100,000 humans and Fae died when the Fae army first appeared in our world. King Oberon ripped through the magical barrier between the Fae realm and ours, shocking us all with the existence of mythical beasts and powerful magic. As I'm sure you remember, the Fae magic destroyed the advanced technology of the French military. The human army was defenseless against magic, and the Fae quickly took over the north of France and the Channel Islands. To save part of the south, the French resorted to old-fashioned cannons that used a scattershot of iron nails. Iron saved the south, thanks to the Fae aversion to iron. The demi-Fae aren't even acting as if they're listening to me anymore. All of them are looking up toward wisps of fog coiling off the eastern veil. I follow their eyes, and my stomach plunges. Two large red beasts swoop through the sky high above the town, wings flapping slowly. God save me. Dragons! I'd seen one 3 days ago, a tiny speck in the distance. These two are much closer, flying just above the town, their scales glimmering in the sunlight. Their heads pivot as they search the earth. My gut tells me that they're looking for these very fugitives, and they could spot them from above, a group of magical beings. They say dragons can smell fear from far away. I try to slow my breathing. If the dragons spot the demi-fae, it'll be over for them.
They'll simply dive and scorch them all, turning them into living torches. It's what they did during the war. The smart thing for me to do would be to bolt, to put as much distance between me and this group of demi-fae as I can. I look at them, huddled, eyes wide and locked on the dragons. The little boy with dirt on his cheek clutches one of the women's legs, and she strokes his shaggy blonde hair absentmindedly. Shit. I can't leave them. My heart thunders. With a racing heart, I glance around. On the beach, people are sitting up and pointing at the sky. Some are smiling, marveling at the beauty of the dragons, drinking champagne. After all, the dragons aren't after them. That means my tour group shouldn't look scared either. They should look relaxed, but excited, getting a glimpse of not one, but two dragons. Real tourists would delight at the chance to tell their friends about this back home. "We are incredibly lucky," I call out gleefully. "Ladies and gentlemen, in the sky, you can see two red dragons. Those majestic beasts work with the Fae to keep our borders secure. Everyone wave at the dragons to thank them for keeping the border safe." I begin to wave enthusiastically, a deranged grin plastered on my face, smiling as if my life depends on it. Which it does. This is my MO. Act like everything is fine, blast people with positivity, and hope for the best. Except the fugitives are frozen in place, not moving. "Elena," I mutter through clenched teeth, "wave at the damn dragons. Look happy." After a second, she starts waving, a rictus grin stretching her lips. Then others follow suit. The dragons glance our way, then turn their heads in disinterest. My chest unclenches. "Okay, folks, the tour continues," I shout, my heart in my throat. "Come on, we still have a lot to see on this glorious day." I lead them up toward the winding stone roads, and the dragons recede into the distance. My pulse is roaring, and I can hardly breathe. I turn back to the demi-fae. They're scared, all looking to me for guidance, and... hang on, there's one missing. That blonde woman I'd grabbed by the hand earlier. "Where's the woman who is with you?" I ask Elena urgently, trying to recall how she looked.
The one with the golden hair and the green skirt?"
Elena blinks and turns around. She looks at one of them and says,
"I have for Vena. Leanchogra, see?"
"Where is Vena? Did she get lost?" He shakes his head helplessly and answers in Fae that he's not sure. She was there just a few minutes ago. He thinks she might have run.
"You've got to be kidding me."
"Okay, wait here," I say. I hurry up the road by the restaurant, searching for Vena on the narrow lane. When I turn a corner, a shimmer of green draws my attention. She's there, racing up a winding road. I take a step after her, then freeze. Two Fae soldiers round a corner, and they're marching toward her. I slip back behind the corner, watching from the safety of a stone wall. Fog curls over the stony street. One of the Fae draws a sword. The wind picks up his white blonde hair, toying with it. His dark velvety cloak billows behind him. He's speaking in Fae, but I can't hear exactly what he's saying. She looks so tiny there, dwarfed by the colorful buildings and the imposing Fae soldiers. She's shaking her head, trying to tell them that she doesn't understand what they're saying, that she can't speak the Fae language. I chance a step forward. I can tell them she's on my tour. "Sorry, officers, those tourists would lose their heads if they weren't attached." The pale-haired soldier swings his sword. A crimson spray spatters on the nearby wall. She topples onto the street, blood gushing down her green skirt. I gasp and slink behind a corner, tears springing to my eyes. The world feels unsteady beneath my feet. Shit, shit, shit! Are there no laws here? Southern France is supposed to be unoccupied, but apparently the Fae can kill in the streets without a trial or even a good reason. I risk a look back, but don't see anyone following me. My breath is ragged in my throat. Either the soldiers didn't see me, or they thought I didn't look like much of a threat. I walk down to the beach, the image of her murder playing in a loop in my mind. She didn't look much older than me, and it was the way she collapsed, just folding onto herself. It all seemed so casual. A lazy swoop of the blade, an arc of blood, a job done. I clamp my eyes shut and bite my lip. The seaside air no longer smells fresh. It feels like I'm inhaling brackish rot. My lungs whistle as I inhale. I'm running out of breath, and this could be a panic attack or my lungs collapsing. Probably both. My airway is narrowed to a single point. I focus on my senses and the feel of the ground beneath my feet to calm myself and ignore the seaside scent of decay. I smell thyme and brine,
the faint whiff of lavender. I feel the kiss of the breeze against my skin. My chest is practically caving in. From my handbag, I pull out my inhaler. Two puffs. Within moments, my airways start to open. I shove the inhaler back into the bag and hurry back over the brush, onto the sand. I shield my eyes and find the group huddled on the beach.
"Where's Vina?"
Elena asks. My heart clenches. I can't lie to them. "Dead," I say. I can't let them linger for someone who's never coming back, or they'll end up bleeding out too. We have to go. Raising my voice, I call out in French, "Okay, everyone, let's continue our tour." The cheer in my tone borders on hysteria. "We need to get to the docks where the French Navy fought the large sea serpent." I walk forward, then glance over my shoulder and motion for them to follow me. Elena's eyes shine, and she follows me resolutely. The rest follow suit. I lead them across the beach, and the sun dips lower in the sky. Twilight stains the clouds with red. As I plod along, I try to keep a smile plastered on my face, though my body is trembling like leaves in the wind. I take them on a grim procession into a network of alleys, a spiderweb of cobbled streets that spread out over the seaside town. While I rattle off random historic facts, my mind is still on Vina. It was the ease with which the Fae soldier had swung his sword, like a bored teenager swinging for a baseball. I've seen a few dead people before, but they were all at funerals, neatly in their coffins, never a murder, never such casual violence. Wrought iron fences and brick buildings crowd the road. As dusk darkens the sky above us, I lead the demi-fae up the hill. As you can see, the gutter runs through the center of the road, a relic of the medieval era. I know no one is listening, but it doesn't matter. I keep going, trying to look casual. Between buildings, we get glimpses of the sea and the coils of mist from the veil. The fog seemed like a fascinating curiosity when I first arrived. Now, it's horrifying. All of this is horrifying. Sweat trickles down my temples. There's no one around, so I drop the tour guide act until I catch a glimpse of Fae soldiers at the bottom of the hill. We're close to the veil here, and it hums in my ears. My tour group still looks terrified, and I wish they'd stop clinging to each other. "We'll turn right here," I call out, and move to turn back down the street, then realize that a couple of patrolling Fae are marching on that road too. I meant left, of course. But now, we're also getting pinned in by the Fae soldiers. I clench my jaw, my mind whirling. I turn toward them, marching backward, beckoning for the group to follow me. "Our tour continues down by the beach!" I take another step back, and Aliana shouts my name in a panic. Violet-sheened fog snakes around me, and my stomach plummets. The misty veil has roiled closer, and it's drawing me in. Magic thrums over my skin, making my teeth chatter. My thoughts go dark, my body cold. I'm inside the veil, and that means I'm about to die. Chapter 3. Like the nightshade flower, the beauty of the veil hides its deadly nature. Fae magic isn't particularly stable, and the results of touching it vary. Some people die of a heart attack, some scream in agony as their insides melt, some turn to dust or freeze solid, but the end is the same. The veil is hungry, and it feeds off death. And yet, despite standing in the midst of it, I'm still alive. Unless, as some people say, the dead don't realize they're dead. Through the coils of fog, I stare down at my hands. The mist shifts and slides over my wrists, strangely sensual in the way it moves like a living thing. I'm still breathing. I don't feel any pain. How long will this death take? I inhale humid air tinged with sea salt. I feel fine. I can't even hear the mists buzzing or feel the prickling of magic on my skin. Strange. Maybe the magic doesn't work in this part of the veil. From here, I can still see the others, silhouettes in silver and violet beyond the veil. From my ankles up, the fog slides under the white lace of my dress like a lover's caress. "Aliena?" I ask.
"You're still alive?"
she asks, shocked. "I can't see you." Hope lights in my chest. "That's perfect, then," I tell her. "This part of the veil is fine. We can hide here, I think. It's not lethal."
"No,"
she mutters, terror in her voice. "It's an in-between space," I say. "I'm fine, and it's the perfect place to hide. And the soldiers are blocking us in right now." The seconds tick by as my anxiety grows. I understand her reluctance, but those soldiers will end up noticing them.
and I can only imagine what will happen then. I'm about to urge her to move when I see a silhouette nod and step forward. Elena's hand comes through the fog, and she takes a deep breath as she sidles up next to me.
"Come on, everyone,"
she whispers in Fae. One by one, the demi-Fae slip into the veil, and instead of draining them of life, the mist seems to welcome them in its embrace. I gesture, and the little boy grasps my hand, joining me. Through the whirls of fog, I can still see the stone alley beneath my feet, but everything's different here beyond the veil. For the past few years, no one has come here at all. Garbage has accumulated in this no-man's land, and the air smells of rot and decay. I swallow. I shouldn't be here. Outside the mist, I see the silhouettes of Fae guards pass by, swords drawn. They don't notice us at all.
"How did you get through the veil the first time?" I ask Aeliana.
"We had a, I don't know how you say it in English, an orb, a cursed orb, but it shattered."
She swallows.
"We lost two people when that happened."
A shiver runs along the back of my neck, but I push the fear away. I count to 10, giving the guards time to walk away, then emerge from the mist. Aeliana follows me, then the rest.
Creeping to the edge of the alley, I peer out. No veil patrols.
Good. "Okay, we're clear," I say. "Let's do the same as before. We're just a group of tourists, okay? It's crucial that you all give the appearance of being calm, even if you don't feel it." Leading them out, I begin hollering inane facts, trying to look as if everything is fine. The temperature drops sharply for some reason, and my teeth chatter. The cold bites at my skin. What is that icy wind? Perhaps it's my body's reaction to the trauma of it all. I just saw a woman executed in the street, her blood drenching her clothes. I accidentally stepped into a magical veil that, through sheer luck, didn't destroy me. My heart thrums in my chest, but I keep talking, giving the tour. I smile, rattling off facts about the heroics of the French army during the invasion, still explaining how lucky we are to have the status quo to protect us. I lead them down the hill toward the dock. My breathing is becoming more labored, wheezy, a constant eerie whistle as I inhale and exhale.
"Are you all right?"
Elena asks.
"You don't sound so good."
"I'm fine," I pant. "I have asthma, stress-induced." With every word I try to inhale, get just a bit more oxygen into my lungs.
"You don't know the city, and you get sick if you exert yourself,"
Elena mutters.
"Why did you think you're the right person to help us?"
"Well, I didn't see anyone else stepping up." My head is spinning. I'll have to take a break soon.
"I'm thankful you did," Elena says.
I raise an eyebrow.
"Thank me when I get you to the docks."
"Where are we? I've led this group down a meandering, unfamiliar street. I've never been this far east before. And when they turn to me, they're all looking at me with expectant faces, trusting me with their lives. Me? The person who once got lost in the neighborhood she lived in. The person who can't read a map to save her life." I look around, desperately searching for anything familiar on the crowded street. Tourist shops line the road, some selling crepes or ice cream, others fae-themed and magical, barebone floral crowns and hazel wands in the windows. A gold-lettered sign above a shop reads, "Château de la Fée." I pause, leaning against a wall to catch my breath. At least I'm starting to warm up again a little. The twilight-streaked sea sparkles under the sun. Thank God. Once we get to the sea, we can figure out which way the docks are. "Follow me to the beach," I call out, breathing in the salt. "We're going to see where the French prepared for the final assault on the Fae fleet, armed with..." I pause at the sight in front of me. We've reached a wide paved road that leads to the docks. Two French policemen are checking people's papers as they pass through. Shit! They can't risk the status quo by letting demi-Fae fugitives through. In fact, that's probably why they're here, searching for these very fugitives.
"They're just human,"
Aeliana whispers in my ear.
"Only two of them. We can fight them. Some of us can make it."
"No," I blurt. "The police have guns, and they will call the Fae soldiers to help them. It's all part of their agreement. You'll die."
"Then we'll die free," Aeliana says.
"That's a nice sentiment, but dead is dead." I think of Vena.
"You've come too far to give up."
I notice that the cops don't check everyone. There's too much traffic, too many passers-by. There are only two of them. They'll definitely stop us, though. Sure, my tour guide act was good enough for the occasional glance, but not for cops who are actually searching for fugitives.
"We'll wait for an opportunity," I say. "I'll create a distraction. You go through doing what I did. Act like the group's tour guide.
Aliena pales.
I don't even speak French.
English will be fine.
She shakes her head.
I don't look anything like a tour guide.
She isn't wrong. While the tourists on the beach might not have noticed that her clothing was off, the police would be looking more closely. They'd see the velvet, the silk, the exquisite tailoring mixed with frayed edges and dirt smudges, the long limbs on display, and they'd recognize a group of demi-fey refugees.
I wish I had a proper disguise for her, something that would make her inconspicuous, but I can't think of anything.
My gaze flicks to the shops, and an idea pops into my mind.
Wait here, I say, and hurry across the road into Chateau de la Fay. It's a crowded shop of strange curiosities. Statues of fey with real butterfly wings glued to them, round bottles of brightly colored syrups labeled as potions, decks of fortune-telling cards with skulls and snakes, leather-bound books in the fey language, antique maps of their realm. But none of that is what I'm looking for, so I press on until I find what I need. I grab it, then rush to the front of the desk. A woman with a tidy gray bun peers at me over her glasses, then demands 70 euros. I pay her, trying not to calculate how many hours working in the bookshop that is. I have more important things to worry about. She stuffs my things into a paper bag. Outside, I hurry back to Aliena and hand her the bag. Put all this on. She peers into the paper bag, and her lip curls.
But why?
A demi-fay would never dress in fairy wings because it's stupid.
They look cheap and ridiculous, and they're the perfect disguise. I've seen a bunch of tour guides wearing wings like those. Some tourists here expect props, you know? They want the whole fey experience. And if you put it on, you won't look fey. No one will think you're fey if you have those wings on. There's a flower crown, too.
Okay, fine.
She snatches the bag from me and pulls on the glittery pink wings with two straps over her shoulders. When she crowns herself with flowers, I breathe a sigh of relief. The costume completely shifts the perspective. Her strange clothing and pointy ears look like part of it now.
Okay, I say. Let's wait for the right opportunity. For now, start doing your tour guide act. I'm going to create a diversion. Go through once I start.
She takes over for me as a guide, speaking in broken English.
Ladies and gentlefolk, this here is the house of a French general. He used deadly iron weapons. He blew up the wicked fey, leaving them in bloody pieces on the road.
Worst tour guide ever, but it would do. Her voice fades as I hurry down the hill toward the docks where sailboats and yachts bob in their moorings. I wait for a few minutes until a policeman starts arguing with an old woman who has forgotten her paperwork. That just leaves one cop.
Excuse me, I shout at him. Excuse-moi, monsieur, comment ça va?
I'm abusing the French language and the cop visibly winces.
I speak English.
My first instinct is flattery.
And you speak it so well. Mais je voudrais pratiquer mon français maintenant. Vous êtes très fashionable,
I say in mangled franglais. His eyes grow hard, and I can tell this tactic isn't working on him. In fact, it's only raising his suspicions. Europeans expect Americans to be loud and obnoxious, and maybe I'd need to turn up the dial on that.
I'm looking for, like, do you know where je voudrais, like, McDonald's or something?
No, move along, please.
He waves me out of the way. This is too important for me to shrink away, and I need his attention on me. And what better focuses a person's attention than loathing?
Is there any decent chocolate in this country?
I ask.
The food in France isn't what it's cracked up to be. No offense, but I thought you were supposed to have good chocolate. Have you tried Hershey's Kisses? Because those are delicious.
His face goes red and he gestures to his left for me to go.
If you please,
he says in a clipped accent. From the corner of my eye, I see Aliena walk past, leading the group and talking about the French Navy like a tour guide. The cop's attention flickers to them for just a moment, and I wave my hand in his face.
Excusez-moi, garçon, do you know McDonald's? Do you have any in this country? McDonald's,
I shout up at him. I can't stomach more of your French crap. He shoots me a withering look. Whoops, overdid it.
Not here.
He purses his lips and points west.
There are plenty of better restaurants in Marseille. An American chocolate is not even real chocolate, legally.
I fold my arms. You must be joking. Have you even tried real pancakes? Not like the weird thin kind you have here, but like a big fluffy pile of real pancakes? Because in America, you can buy frozen ones that have a sausage in them and maple flavor already on it. You just heat them up and boom, there's your breakfast. And that kind of innovation is why America is the greatest nation in the world. It frees up extra time for more work hours. Amazing, right? By the time he shoots a pleading expression at the second cop, Aliena's group is already gone. Anyway, thanks. I turn away from him, relieved I can drop the act.
Mademoiselle, can I just see your passport?
He asks from behind me. He sounds pissed. I turn back to him and clear my throat. Sure, officer, is there a problem?
No, just a routine check.
Thankfully, I have my passport with me. I reach into my bag and pull it out. He stares at it so long that my heart pounds.
Nia Melisande?
He asks. I'm American, I say hopefully. He flips through the passport, then hands it back to me.
Have a pleasant day,
he says, sounding bored. Merci beaucoup. I start walking toward the docks.
Mademoiselle, the restaurants are the other way.
Oh, yes, thank you. I just want to take a photo of the pretty French boots. I smile at him and turn away. When I'm sure he's no longer looking, I break into a little run, my boots creaking over the wood. It takes me a few minutes to locate Eliana and the rest of the group, who are standing by a large clipper ship. Eliana is talking to a man on the deck, another demi-fay. His pointed ears rise out of wavy dark hair that falls to his sharp jawline. The sleeves of his white shirt are rolled up, exposing tattoos that snake around his muscled forearms. As I take a step closer, my heart skips a beat. The moment he cuts me a sharp look, I recognize those eerie silver eyes, the straight black eyebrows. And yet, he seems a million times bigger, towering over everyone else, shoulders as broad as a doorframe. So that's what happened to Raphael Lancelot, the beautiful demi-fay who broke my heart. Chapter 4. I stare at him. Mouth ajar. I spent so long trying to forget about him and that night in Bordeaux, when the stars shone so brightly and the air smelled heavy with ripening grapes. And now, Raphael is standing before me, looking like a damn demigod. We met at a chateau during our summer trip, and after we kissed, he never spoke to me again. I also remember hearing him call me trash after Mom fell down the stairs drunk one night. He is, in fact, a million times better looking than Jules the waiter, which is endlessly frustrating. You can tell by his bearing that he knows how beautiful he is, too. Sun-kissed skin, muscular physique, the piercing silver eyes. I loathe the man. From the top of the gangplank, he glances at me for a fraction of a moment, but if he recognizes me, he doesn't let it show. A woman in a blue dress stands by the main mast, demanding the names of every female.